the combination of evaporative cooling and wind speed that's provided by the tunnel ventilation allows the birds to thrive now in the summer. I talked about the mortality, which was horrible because it was always the biggest birds that seemed to be the most susceptible to hot weather, just like humans. You know, a big guy is going to be a whole lot more susceptible to hot weather. He's going to suffer in hot weather a lot more than a skinny little teenager. So that was an issue, but probably the biggest issue was the weight gain that was lost on the birds that went to market. Because, you know, just like us, if it's hot, we don't feel like eating. And if a chicken doesn't feel like eating, it's not growing.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
AccuGut C.1 is a proven solution for your coccidiosis toolbox. Give those traditional tools a break and rotate to AccuGut C.1. Visit dsm-firmanich.com/AccuGut to learn more. AB Vista, intelligent nutritional solutions to boost poultry health and performance. Natural Biologics is looking deeper to find the natural solutions to your poultry health challenges. Nexus, powered by SAM, where science meets performance. Sid Lines, an Ecolab company, AV Prime program offers a broad range of cleaning and disinfection solutions combined with tailored advice to improve hygiene on your farm or hatchery. Probiotech International is driven by innovation, inspired by nature, and passionate about contributing to a more sustainable, safe, and healthy food system. We work closely with our customers to deliver solutions to current and future challenges facing the animal production sector while using natural active ingredients such as chemotypes and polyphenols derived from plant extracts and spices. Our products follow a rigorous scientific validation process. They are then proven to work through thorough field research, certified for quality, and then brought to market as a complete and effective solution. In a world filled with rapid change, let Probiotech International deliver your opportunities for solutions and savings to your program. Innovation is in our nature. Visit probiotech.com/EN for more information.
Phil Stair with Wisenetics, and we're with Dr. Mike Lacey, Professor Emeritus, University of Georgia. And we've had a good conversation before we started recording, Mike, but maybe folks who don't know you, which I can't imagine anybody that doesn't, want to just give me a little bit of history about yourself?
I'm a poultry scientist, got my training at Virginia Tech, went to work at the University of Georgia in 1985, worked there as an extension specialist for about 15 years, doing work in housing, environmental control of poultry houses, broiler houses. Then lost my mind and let them talk me into becoming department head. I did that for 16 years and retired a few years ago, and now am enjoying grandchildren. I still do a little bit of poultry work. I'm on the board of directors of the World Poultry Foundation that does some philanthropic work in developing countries, trying to help them with food security around poultry, meat, and eggs.
That's a great, great story. And a long time at Georgia. It's a
long time, 32 years. Yes.
So you're definitely part of the history of the poultry industry. And we had a conversation about that. And you talk about working around the world. I think it'd be a good conversation to talk about origins of poultry in the U.S. and even how chickens got here. If you want to go through that, it'd be great.
Yeah. To me, it's such an interesting story how, you know, chickens are the most, there are more chickens in the world than any other bird. I think there's some kind of finch in Africa that's, you know, got 2 billion of those, but we got 9 billion chickens in the world at any time. So from a evolutionary standpoint, chickens have come out on top there. And I think that's justified because there's such an interesting animal, such a neat animal. I've more fascinated with them as the years have gone by. But the theory is that chickens originated from a ground-dwelling pheasant-type bird in Southeast Asia, the red jungle fowl. And those things are wild. I mean, if we had a a couple of them at the University of Georgia that we kept for demonstration purposes. And, you know, a regular chicken, you can catch one of those and pet it like a, and, you know, some people do have chickens for pets, but that red jungle fowl, if you could catch it, it was like holding a stick of dynamite. It was like ready to explode if you loosened your grip on it. It definitely was a flighty, just a wild animal. And the theory is, one of the theories, at least, the one that I subscribe to, the one that I like most, is that the red jungle fowl was not domesticated originally for meat or eggs. In fact, the things are so skinny and wiry and lay so few eggs, you wouldn't be able to get a Chick-fil-A sandwich out of them or a decent omelet. The theory is that they were originally domesticated because the males were so aggressive and would fight one another to protect their territory and their little harem of hens. And every army that would come into Southeast Asia, I think the Persians were the first to come in there and invade, they would see these fighting chickens that the locals had kept for entertainment purposes around the campfire. You know, they didn't have video games or that kind of thing. So every army that came in there would see these fighting chickens. And of course, the military guys would say, okay, this is pretty cool. And they would take them back home. The Greeks conquered the Persians, Alexander the Great. They saw the fighting chickens that the Persians had, took them back to Greece. The Romans conquered the Greeks eventually, took them back to Rome. And the Romans went nuts over chickens, partly because of the fighting thing and how successful the Romans were in all military matters. But the Romans also were particularly superstitious. And, you know, they looked at tea leaves and innards of animals and that kind of thing to try to predict the future. And they thought that chickens could predict the future. In fact, there's a famous story. There was a Roman admiral that I think he was mad at Carthage. He was attacking Carthage. And the Romans, before they would go into battle, they would consult the chickens to see if they were going to be successful in battle or not. And every Roman army, every Roman armada ship, that kind of thing, had a little flock of chickens. And the chicken keeper was in an exalted position. I keep thinking I was born in the wrong era. You know, if I'd been a Roman, I would have been a lot more famous and respected. But the chicken keeper would be called out by the general, the admiral, and would throw out grain. And if the chickens ate hungrily, that was a sign that the army was going to be successful. The Romans were going to be successful. And of course, the Romans almost always won, so they must have had hungry chickens most of the time. But this one particular admiral on his ship called out the chicken keeper, threw grain out on the deck. And I don't know if the chickens were seasick or what the problem was, but they did not eat. The Roman admiral was really, he was anxious to fight. So he got mad at the chicken keeper and the chickens. He said, well, if they're not hungry, perhaps they're thirsty. And he threw them overboard and went and attacked Carthage. And as the history books say, it was the worst Roman naval defeat in history. The whole Roman navy ended up on the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea that day. So I used to tell my students, don't mess with the chickens. You know, you never know. Don't mess with the chickens. So the Romans, of course, conquered the world. Every Roman army had a little chicken flock with it. They took chickens from, you know, from one side of Europe to the other. And that's really how chickens got spread from Southeast Asia to all over the world. Another interesting thing, I think, happened in England in the 1800s. As I said, the chickens were mainly, by that time, they were being used for food. The Romans had all kinds of recipes for chicken soup, medicinal purposes and that kind of thing. Eggs were a popular food, but still not as popular as beef or pork or that kind of thing. Chickens were sort of a afterthought. But in the 1800s, Queen Victoria had just become queen. She was young, and somehow they've been trying to open up trade with China. England, you know, made all their money by trading all over the world, and they finally had opened up trade with China. They wanted China's silk and tea and jade and that kind of thing, and China always had this sort of closed society kind of thing, built the Great Wall to keep out Attila the Hun and that kind of thing. But the English finally got China to start trading with them. And one of the first things that came over on one of the first ships from China to England was a present for Queen Victoria. And they brought these Chinese Cochin chickens to England. And you would have thought aliens had landed. As I said, you know, China kind of separated themselves. Chickens had gone west with the Romans, but they also had gone east into China, and nobody had seen these Chinese chickens for like centuries. China had the right idea. They had bred these Cochin chickens that were like 4 or 5 times the size of the English chicken. And the newspaper said, they went crazy. They said these things were as big as ostriches. They roared like lions. And people would come. Queen Victoria had to put them on display. People would come by and you know, visit them like they were zoo animals. That set off what they call hen fever in England, which spread to Europe and the United States, where everybody thought that they were a chicken breeder. It was time, you know, kind of a time of science being popularized. You had the apple falling and hitting Newton on the head. You had Pasteur doing the stuff with microbes. You had Mendel doing the genetics things. And everybody in England and Europe and eventually the United States started breeding chickens. And that's where we came up with all of this genetic diversity in chickens that has resulted in chickens becoming one of the most efficient protein sources from both an egg and a meat standpoint. I used to say the most efficient, but the catfish people got mad at me for about that. Catfish do, they can beat us.
Yeah, if we put chickens in a weightless environment, they might can be the same, but yeah, fish got to speed on that, yeah.
That's right. In a nutshell, how we got chickens from one end of the world to the other, and how that genetic diversity that is so wonderful in chickens has provided such a variety that where the chicken can be bred to produce, you know, 300 eggs a year. Some breeds can produce close to 300 eggs a year, or you can meat type chicken that can convert feed to meat at a ratio of less than 1.8 pounds of feed to a pound of meat. It is an amazing animal.
Well, let's buy some of the history in the United States. That's good. I mean, I didn't know all about the Romans carrying chickens around. That's good. I got a different perspective now.
Yeah, they were crazy.
You're part of the U.S. History. So now my first job out of school was working for Arbor Acres, and that line now part of Avigen.
So yeah. You know the genetic ends of things.
Well, I saw part of it. I don't think I know it, but definitely the selection has given us incredible animals. And you look at the trajectory of the genetics, and still a straight line. It's not plateaued yet. The weight gains and feed conversions are all going the right way in terms of progress. We might want to talk about that in terms of, I know, your impact on the building component, you know, adapting housing for Asian animals in the U.S. You may want to address that, how you've done that through the years.
The chicken is just an amazing success story in terms of producing meat and eggs. And the genetics are a huge part of it. I would say, you know, when people have tried to figure out, okay, what makes the difference? Is it genetics? Is it the improved feed? Is it the improved housing? Genetics is probably more than 70% of it. The geneticists have just done an amazing job. The feed is also important. We know more about feeding chickens than we do any other animal, including humans. I mean, the science behind feeding chickens is just incredible. And of course, your end of things, the veterinary medicine end of things, the vaccinations that have come from the poultry side of things have helped human medicine. First vaccine for cancer, leukosis, came from the chicken end of things. So there's no question that the veterinary medicine part of it has played a tremendous part in being able to raise chickens in order to feed the world. And my part, the housing part, was a small part of it. You've got to have a good environment in order for a bird to thrive. You've got to have a good environment for a bird to be healthy. I think there's always a battle between nutritionists and veterinarians. You know, if the birds weren't doing well, was it the nutritionist's fault or the veterinarian's fault? Sometimes it was just bad environment and wouldn't have made any difference what the feed or what the veterinary care was. It was just a bad environment. So my work back in the early 80s, we always had problems with heat stress in the summer. Most of the broilers in the United States are grown in the southern states, and it gets hot in Georgia and Mississippi and Texas and Alabama, Louisiana. And we would always have problems with the birds, high mortality in the summer, if particularly if there was a sudden heat wave. The birds just couldn't acclimate quickly enough, and birds don't have sweat glands. They've got all those feathers that insulate them so well. So if you can't keep them cool, they're going to have issues. A brilliant ag engineer, Mike Zarek, and I at the University of Georgia worked on trying to come up with better ways to ventilate houses during the summertime, and sort of took tunnel ventilation and worked on evaporative cooling to where if it was a 100-degree day in South Georgia and I needed a cool place to try to recover from the heat, I'd go find a chicken house because it would be cool in there. The combination of evaporative cooling and wind speed that's provided by the tunnel ventilation allows the birds to thrive now in the summer. I talked about the mortality, which was horrible because it was always the biggest birds that seemed to be the most susceptible to hot weather, just like humans, you know. A big guy is going to be a whole lot more susceptible to hot weather. He's going to suffer in hot weather a lot more than a skinny little teenager. So that was an issue. But probably the biggest issue was the weight gain that was lost on the birds that went to market. Because, you know, just like us, if it's hot, we don't feel like eating. And if a chicken doesn't feel like eating, it's not growing. So we probably did more to help the industry and in terms of increasing weight gain or not losing that weight gain during the hot summer months than anything else.
That's a good story. I think too, when I started back in the early 90s, my career, there's still a lot of cross ventilated houses, with curtains and drop down and clear curtains were going to dark curtains. And finally, now the new construction, solid wall with tunnel ventilation, even in the deep south where it's hot all the time.
I didn't think you were that old, Phil.
Well, some places aren't as fast to move as others. You know? So not everybody adopted the new technology, I think back, the first pads I saw were spray-on pads.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Well, even before that, they just had foggers in front of a crack opening the openings. And then,
exactly. We would try to fog the house down and try not to wet the floors too much.
So I think there's been a lot of good things. And I guess I'm a technology proponent. You know, I think some of the turn the birds loose type of thing for, you know, whatever, a visual and optic may not be the best thing for the chicken. about where the chicken came from. The chickens make it around the world, but chicken still came from an Asian climate. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's right.
So how do we accommodate that? You know, the chickens, you know, like you say, went with the Romans up to Great Britain and all in the northern environs and down south, south of the equator. What does a chicken really want? You know, when we talk about welfare, what's the best environment for a chicken? Can we answer that?
Yeah, that's an age-old question. And I think we are doing a much better job of understanding the behavior and the needs of the chicken now. You know, every poultry company now has got a welfare, has got somebody that's in charge of animal welfare. That wasn't the case 30 years ago, 20 years ago even. But the poultry companies now take that very seriously, and they should. I think that's important. It's something that needs to be front and center is the welfare of the animal. Because the animal that's not well cared for is not going to grow, not going to produce eggs. It's going to cost a company in the long run. So taking good care of the animals is important, not only from a humane standpoint, but also from an economic standpoint.
So even as an engineer, I guess, animal behavior, you had to become an animal behaviorist when you're working with animal housing. And through your years of working with the animals, any observations or things you would tell another generation what to look for? How do you know chicken's comfortable?
You know as well as I do that an experienced poultry person can go into a poultry house and tell pretty much right off the bat whether those chickens are comfortable or not. And it's a feeling that you get. You see the birds, particularly, you know, bird that's 2 or 3 weeks old, you see them running around playing with one another. They're moving around. They're alert. You can tell they're happy in there. And if you go in a house and you see them all huddled up, you know, laying around trying to just minimize their movement and that kind of thing, save their energy, you know, okay, something's wrong here. There's a problem. So it's more observation and seeing lots of birds and knowing what a healthy flock looks like and what one that there's some issue here. You can listen to birds. I've heard veterinarians talk 1,000 times about hearing a little rattle or a little sneeze or a little snoot or that kind of thing.
So
you can hear what's going on in a poultry house just by being quiet and listening to what's going on. So I can't say that there's a secret to it other than I think the activity level was always important to see the chicks kind of pitter pattering around, you know, not hovering under a brooder because they're too cold or laid out trying to cool themselves off because they're too warm. There's a definite behavior there that you can tell, okay, this house is comfortable. These birds are comfortable. They're going to thrive.
Yeah, I think you talk from one experienced poultryman to another. And I think, you know, part of my job now as a consultant is sharing some of our observations with the next generation. And it does take time. It takes time to understand the animal. And watching the animal, as you said, we are charged, all of us at an animal industries with animal husbandry to take care of the animals. And it's not what we want. It's what they need. And I think you're right. Definitely the companies have gotten more, I would say, progressive with that or more interested or more committed. There's a whole departments now to not just animal welfare, but animal well-being, you know, caretake, comfort. And I think that's justifiable. That's all good. There's also some technology you're probably aware of where recording, they're listening to the houses now with computers and getting some baselines, actually using artificial intelligence to understand what the population should sound like and when it doesn't sound right, to make alerts. I think those are good things. I think they're helpful things.
Universities also have gotten better about doing research in animal welfare. Because you, like, when you ask me, you know, how do you tell if a chicken is happy or not? That's a really hard thing to do. So the university have gotten serious about it. Now almost every poultry science department has got somebody that specializes in animal welfare and does research in that area, trying to figure out from a scientific viewpoint, how do you measure welfare?
Yes, and I think that is a challenge, but you do go back to it. It's hard to short-circuit experience. Now, if you've been around the animals, been watching, and I have a good friend that says you listen to the chickens, you know, they'll tell you what's going on.
Exactly. They'll speak to you. You're exactly yeah. right. They're smart.
Yeah. Yes. So in terms of impacts, I mean, this Wisenetics whole podcast is about sharing knowledge and passing it on to other folks. As you think forward, you know, your years that you've seen the progress, can you see down the road further what's coming? Can you see other maybe things that need to be changed?
I gave up trying to predict the future in the poultry industry a long time ago. That's another thing that's so amazing about the poultry industry is how innovative they are and how they're always trying to think of a better way to do something. And that speaks to the efficiency of the industry. I mean, it's just incredible that you can go and buy a dozen eggs, even during inflationary times, that you can buy a dozen eggs for $2 a dozen or a package of poultry meat for, you know, $2 a pound. It is incredible. And maybe going back and talking a little bit about how the industry has evolved, since I can't predict the future.
But, there you go. Yeah.
To show just how the industry has gone from the 1800s, you know, we're talking a couple hundred years ago. It sounds like forever, but in terms of human history, it's like a blip. Back then, you know, virtually every farm had a little flock of chickens, and it was the farm wife's job to take care of the chickens. Men didn't mess with the chickens. They were out plowing the fields, taking care of the cows and the pigs and that kind of thing, but the chickens were the woman's venue. And actually, rural sociologists say that was sort of the beginning of women's independence, women's rights, because if they had a few extra chickens or a few extra eggs, they could trade those or sell those. And that money they kept, that was their hen money or their
egg money.
Yep. Their egg money. And they would buy shoes for the kids or, you know, maybe some material to make clothes or that kind of thing. But it gave them some economic independence, probably the first that they had ever had. And agricultural experts back then said, you know, you'll never be able to compete with the farm wife. Her labor is free. Her feed is free. You know, she's feeding scraps from the table and what little bit of leftover moldy corn that they've got or that kind of thing. You'll never be able to compete with that. And as you would expect, a woman proved them wrong. The story goes that in the 1920s, a woman, Cecile Steele, on the Delmarva Peninsula, I think she lived in Ocean View, Delaware. As the farm wives would do back then, they would order 25, 50, maybe 100 chicks each spring from a local hatchery. You could order them from Sears. And they would come in the mail. And every spring, the farm wife, if she needed to replenish her flock, would order 25, 50 chicks. So Mrs. Steele in 1923 ordered 50 chicks from the local hatchery. The delivery man came, and somehow they had made a mistake, and they delivered 500 instead of 50. And they wouldn't take them back. You know, we filled all the orders. You figure out what to do with them. We don't want them back. You keep them. So she, being the frugal farm wife couldn't bear to, she couldn't give them away. Everybody had their chicks. She couldn't bear to let them go to waste. So she put them in a piano box, this huge piano box, and brooded them, and then quickly got a neighbor to help her build a little chicken house quickly before they got big enough to where they'd outgrown the piano box. And she grew out those 500 chicks and put them on a truck and took them to Philadelphia and sold them for 62 cents a pound, live weight. There have been times in the poultry industry, if we got 62 cents a pound, we would have been made, you know, turning cartwheels. So she, that was big money in 1923. I mean, that was huge money. So the next year she ordered 1,000 chicks and made sure that the hatchery got it right, did the same thing. The following year, Mr. Steele quit his job and went to work for Mrs. Steele. They ordered 10,000 chicks, and the rest is history. I guess 10 years later, there were 7 million broiler chickens being grown on the Delmarva Peninsula because her neighbors, Mrs. Steele's neighbors, had seen what a roaring success this had been. Plus, they were desperate. Seems like every time that the poultry industry grew or made a big change in its history, it had to do with some crop failure. And on the Delmarva Peninsula, they had peaches and strawberries, and a blight had come through and wiped out both of those major crops. So people were in on the Delmarva Peninsula were desperate for something else to turn to, and they turned to Mrs. Steele's idea about growing chickens and selling them to Philadelphia, New York, Washington, Baltimore, those big cities in the area. So that was really the start of the modern poultry industry in the United States. And I think it's fitting that a woman was the main force in that. Now, there were other pioneers as well. One of my favorites was a Jesse Jewell in Georgia. His father owned a feed mill in Gainesville, Georgia, which is now claims to be the poultry capital of the world, which may be true. Chickens are a big deal there. They got statues to chickens, et cetera. But this was the 1920s. Jesse's father owned a feed mill. Unfortunately, his father passed away, and the feed mill was going under. This was right in the throes of the Depression. Georgia farmers had made all their money for centuboll on cotton, and the boll weevil had come through in the 1920s and decimated the cotton crop all across the Southeast. So the Georgia farmers had nothing to turn to. Jesse and his family were in dire straits because farmers didn't have any money to buy feed. Jesse came up with the idea of giving farmers chicks, baby chicks, and giving them feed. And then in payment, he would take back a portion of the chickens that the farmers grew. So it was a win-win kind of thing. He could sell the chickens. He would put the chickens put them on trains and transport them live to the major markets on the East Coast. There'd be a little chicken keeper on each train car to keep the chickens fed and water. I'm glad I wasn't born in that era. Yeah. That wouldn't have been such a hot job. Yeah. And that was wildly successful. The farmers loved it. It was a way for them to keep from starving to death. They were able to get some money for their chickens. Jesse was able to keep the feed mill going. And as time went on, he realized, okay, I'm buying these baby chicks. I need to build a hatchery. So he built a hatchery to supply chicks to his farmers. And then after a while, he said, why am I putting these birds on a train and carrying them live to these places where they're going to going to go to butcher shops or processing or whatever in the East Coast, I'm going to build a processing plant here in Gainesville. So he had the feed mill, the hatchery, the processing plant, and that was the beginning of vertical integration in the poultry industry, which has turned out to be the way now that modern poultry are grown all over the world. And really, as I think I was telling you earlier when we were chatting before the podcast started, it is an American success story because nobody can produce chickens as efficiently as the American poultry industry. And we have spread that efficiency and that ability to feed the world all over Southeast Asia, Europe, South America. And I, like I said, it's just an amazing American success story.
It's a good story. It's definitely to be proud of being a part of the poultry industry. I do think, not just taking care of the animals, but we're taking care of people. Both livelihood and also feeding people an affordable protein that pretty much every culture can accept. Any religion, I don't think there's a religion out there that wouldn't consume poultry. So you think of just the availability and widespread acceptance. It's been a great story. And you've been a big part of that, Dr. Lacey. I think, I've been proud of your time at Georgia and now as a grandparent and enjoying grandchildren, but you're still impacting industry and your continued roles, which, again, I would thank you as a not quite as a mature member of the industry as you are, but definitely catching up. It's been a great conversation.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You're a good example. As neat as I think the chicken is, I think the other thing that has impressed me is how great, what good people there are in the poultry industry. They're just great folks to work with whose heart is in the right place in terms of taking care of the animal and feeding the world.
It's time for our famous three.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boehringer Ingelheim, health experts bring industry-leading knowledge and expertise to today's poultry producers to help them solve challenging health issues through smart, science-driven decision-making using the best resources available. Probiotech International, creating the next generation of feed and water additives to improve animal nutrition, health, and well-being. Innovation is in our nature. Visit probiotech.com/EN for more information. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge. Adiseo provides nutritional solutions and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. Making life easier for animals and those who care for them is the mission of Jeffo. Boehringer Ingelheim develops poultry vaccines of unparalleled quality. With a focus on prevention and control across a wide range of diseases, we deliver unique, sustainable solutions for broilers, layers, breeders, and turkeys. Our veterinary network brings unsurpassed knowledge and experience, helping producers make smart, innovative, science-driven decisions to improve bird health and performance. For more information, visit PoultryHealthUSA.com.
They have three questions they want us to ask the interviewer, interviewees, I guess. One is, what book or resource has been your most impactful in poultry? If there's one reference or one resource that you've used the most of the years.
From an academic standpoint, I would say it was Sturkey's Physiology of the Fowl, but I wouldn't ask anybody to read that. They didn't a little bit crazy about chickens.
Yeah.
One that I enjoy for, and I think the general public would enjoy, is here it is. Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. How about that for a title?
Oh, that's cool. That's a good title. Yeah.
That's by Andrew Lawler. It's a good read. It's a fun read.
Okay. Yeah, I'll get that myself. And then the second question he has on the personal side, what's been a book or reference or it's been most impactful to you, not professionally, but personally?
Well, no question about that. The Bible, for sure. That is the greatest book of it of all time.
And then the third question I'd like us to ask is, what do you think it takes or what to make people successful? What have you seen as successful people in the poultry industry versus not successful people? What would you give guidance, counsel to help new people out?
I used to call it want to. You've got to want to be successful. You've got to want to. And if you don't have the want to, you'll never be successful. That is so many things. That's work ethic, attitude, positive attitude, a little bit of ambition, but not too much. And a really strong dose of teamwork.
If you got out of soon enough, or if you've got to see the generation that doesn't show up to work on time.
Yeah. It drives you crazy, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it's gotten to be, unfortunately, why a lot of the young folks don't stick, is they just don't show up.
Yeah. I mean, there's not a whole lot to being successful in life. If you can show up on time, you've pretty much got it.
Yeah.
If you're reliable and show up on time, you pretty much got it made.
Yeah, that's what I tell my son. He just started to work for Simmons Foods up in Northwest Arkansas.
Oh my goodness, you have initiated him right.
Well, I don't know about that. He's food science, and so if you just show up every day, you'll be ahead of your peers. You know, just be there. Yeah. Well, Dr. Lacy, I think we're going to call this a wrap, but I do appreciate you participating with WiseNetics and sharing your knowledge, your experience. I learned a lot today. Which
my pleasure, Phil. It was fun talking with you.
Been a good history lesson, and if we don't know where we came from, we don't know where we're going.
So that's good
conversation. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.